This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. On this day, 100 years ago, Tennessee became the final state needed to ratify the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, making women's right to vote the law of the land. One historian in the Chattanooga area who knows that story well is Linda Moss Mines.
Linda, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We are talking history, and we are talking the history of Tennessee and the 19th Amendment. Tell us about this centennial.
Oh my goodness, it's such an exciting time because, and I think especially for people who are younger than me, or even for me, since I'm not old enough to remember it, that we often take for granted the rights and privileges that we have as citizens of the country today, and we don't realize that in 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was written, in 1789, when the Constitution was written, there was no consideration for women in any role of citizenship, with voting being our primary responsibility. If you fast forward from 1776 to 1848, you have the first meeting of women, along with some men of future ideology, meeting at Seneca Falls to talk about a suffrage movement for women. And out of that came a lot of conversation and a lot of efforts, but no change to the U.S. Constitution to allow that. I find it interesting that from then, 1848, it is another 72 years exactly. And in 1920, we're going to see the face of citizenship in this country change. 1919, the U.S. Congress introduced into both houses and actually brought them to the floor, voted positively, and brought them out a change to the U.S. Constitution that would become the 19th Amendment. Very short and sweet statement that said that the right to vote would no longer be impaired by gender. President Wilson signs it, and the ratification process requires that it go to the states and that three-fourths of the states have to ratify that amendment. We had 48 states at the time, so 36 had to vote positively. And it wasn't certain that that would happen because for 26 years prior to 1919, a version of the 19th Amendment had been introduced to the U.S. Congress every year, and it had never even made it out of the two bodies. Now it's headed to the states, but that's even more uncertain because there were so many geographical ideological differences in how they viewed the right of women to vote.
A different ideological map than the ones that we can draw today.
Oh, certainly. Very much different ideologically. And, you know, you look back, and I've spent a lot of time over the last year reading the speeches of those who were in favor of the suffrage movement, speeches of those who were adamantly opposed to it. And it centers around social, political ideology, issues of faith, I mean, economics. It's a really interesting discussion when you look at it. But what we, of course, know now, and we will be celebrating, is Tennessee's vote. And it was the most historic of all of the state votes because as that amendment came out of Congress in 1919, almost immediately seven states ratified it. Michigan, New Jersey, a number of states in the Northeast, and then in spurts, additional states would ratify it. But when it came down to the summer of 1920, there were seven states left that had not voted on it. A number of states had voted no. There was pretty strong evidence of those seven states that only two were really in play, and that was Delaware and Tennessee. And Delaware had come out, the governor of Delaware had come out in favor of it, but he lost control of his own political party. They split on him. And all of a sudden, the entire eyes of the nation are focused on Nashville, Tennessee, quite frankly, as they often should be, but nonetheless, they're focused on Nashville, and no one knew what was going to happen. I mean, it was a hot, humid summer. You know, the Yellow Rose suffragettes are there campaigning. The Red Rose anti-suffragettes are there campaigning. And what people sometimes forget is that in every legislature across the nation that's going to be voting on this, it's 100% male. So those who are campaigning in either way have to be quite persuasive and eloquent in their arguments. And it was uncertain. The members of the House of Representatives, the Senate in Tennessee passed it very, very quickly. the House of Representatives was much more divided. You know, you could sometimes gauge because the men would wear either a red rose or a yellow rose in the lapel, but at times they didn't wear either because they were uncertain. And that was a good way of knowing they were uncertain. There are wonderful stories of suffrage workers on either side chasing members of the House of Representatives through the halls of the Capitol. The Capitol was open to the public back then. And one of my favorite stories of all times involves a member of the House who just was not committing himself either way, and a suffrage worker had him cornered talking to him and actually took a hold of his tie to try and keep him focused on her argument. And he reached in his pocket, took out his pocket knife, cut his tie off, and fled into the men's room. Can't you just see that image? Unfortunately, when he came out of the men's room, she was standing in the doorway waiting for him. So she followed him until she could not enter the chamber floors. But I mean, that's how much passion there was in this. And of course, on August the 18th, 100 years to the day, the House of Representatives, in a vote that came down to the final vote, decided to ratify the 19th Amendment. And the minute that it came out of the chambers, the word spread that the House had ratified that amendment, joining with the Senate. Governor Roberts, who was from Overton County, Tennessee, Livingston, agreed to sign it. Of course, nationwide, there was pandemonium. People were either celebrating in every way with ticker tape parades and everything, or they were taking to their fainting couches. The end of society as they knew it was over. I mean, it's so hard to downplay how emotional it was for folks. Harry T. Byrne, who cast that vote from McMinn County, Athens, Tennessee, youngest member of the House of Representatives, and I think probably everyone who's listening has probably heard the story that his mother telegrammed him and quite succinctly said, "Please help Mrs. Catt put the rat in ratification." He votes positively, and those who were opposed to the vote turned on him, and he fled the chambers. And the story is, and the Capitol historian has told me this, that he went all the way to the top of the building, out a window, and sat on the roof for several hours waiting for things to calm down so that he could come back in. They didn't know where he had gone. And I guess they didn't think to look out the window and see him sitting on the roof. Interestingly, you know, you do that at age 27 and you become a national figure, and probably he never anticipated that as the youngest member of the House. You go to the House as a newly elected representative, a young member, and, you know, the first time or two, you're sort of quiet, you do your work. He's nationally prominent that very first time, and it pushes Tennessee into being the perfect 36, which I love. I love to know that Tennessee, which I think has always had an interesting dichotomy of being a southern state and conservative in some areas, but also progressive in other areas. And I love that it puts us right there as the bridge between everything that's important and voting rights being one of the most important things that we enjoy as citizens.
I spoke last month with Paula Casey. One of the things we talked about was how recent so much of the recognition is across Tennessee, and I'm sure that Paula has had a lot to do with that, and you and other historians have had a lot to do with that. Tell us more.
Well, and that's so true, because I think that because the early states that jumped on the bandwagon got a lot of attention, and I think even though Tennessee came down to be the perfect 36, I think a lot of the credit for the recognition goes to Paula in particular, because she's been working this area for 20 years trying to bring attention, having others of us that are historians go back and look at the newspaper accounts of the day, to look at the firsthand person accounts of the day, and to get that story out, because as a rule, the truth of the matter is we don't control the media markets nationally. Those are New York, California, Washington, D.C., Chicago, perhaps. More and more we have input, but I think those early stories just disappeared very quickly, and it was not a primary charge of anyone to keep that story alive.
Beyond all eyes on Nashville, on the centennial, what plans are there to further recognize Chattanooga's role in all this?
We are doing a number of things in Chattanooga, and I'm so glad that you asked that, because, you know, on the Centennial Monument that is in Nashville in Centennial Park, Chattanooga is represented by Abby Crawford Milted, and she is our treasure. Just an absolutely amazing woman who was an attorney by trade, who gets involved very early in the suffrage movement. She becomes the very first president of the Tennessee League of Women Voters. She is the first president of the Tennessee Women's Suffrage Association. She will crisscross the state, all counties, often with her three young daughters accompanying her, because her story says that she said, what better way to learn history than to be a part of it? And I kind of like that. So here in Chattanooga, we're going to be doing a number of things. COVID has impacted some of the things that we had hoped to do. We were going to have a glorious yellow rose tea at Abby Crawford Milton's house, which is now owned by Leah Golden, and she had graciously agreed to that. Well, of course, we can't do that, but we will be celebrating. You'll see signs all over the city talking about Chattanooga's role in the centennial of suffrage. We have a special campaign going on in cooperation with Blood Assurance, the Chattanooga Hamilton County Yellow Rose Committee, with the Chattanooga Bar Association and the Chief John Ross Chapter of the DAR, for a campaign for blood, plasma, and platelets. And anyone who donates, you know, you get a wonderful certificate and a social media posting. You are donating in honor of the first woman in your family to vote. Do you know who your first woman in your family to vote was, Ray? Because I didn't.
It'd have to be one of my great-grandmothers. Guessing off the top of my head which one, this would be the great-grandmother that was also a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Oh, and I bet she did, because they were very heavily involved in the campaign, and she probably had a very strong opinion, then probably furthered that vote by continuing with that strong opinion. It's just kind of fascinating, because here I've worked in the area, you know, for several years, and I got to thinking, trying to figure out who was the first woman probably to vote, and it came down to my York great-grandmother was the very first one to vote, and she voted, actually the story is, in opposition to her husband. They were split parties. And she apparently was quite proud of the fact that she had canceled his vote for the first time after all those years of being married.
That doesn't happen anymore, does it?
Isn't that one of the wonderful things about having a free republic is that each person votes their conscience. And you don't have to share that information with each other. We often do. But without the role of active, involved citizens, the republic would fail. So, you know, I'm constantly running around with my flag on one side and my please vote on the other side, because this form of government doesn't work without informed electorate.
All right. Linda, thanks so much.
Oh, listen, let's talk history again someday soon.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
I'm Will Davis, and this is Tennessee Valley StoryCorps. Stories from people who went to the StoryCorps mobile recording booth when it came to Chattanooga last year. Today, friends Lanisha Gatewood and Nikki Lewis talk about the influence Black culture has within their community.
Where did you grow up? So I actually come from East Atlanta in a very weird time. The KKK was actually still meeting on top of Stone Mountain in 1996.
Wow, really? I've heard of Stone Mountain.
And then in 20 years, it's become one of the number one places for hip hop, one of the in the world, number one place for filming studios, mm-hmm. and it's art entertainment, and it's become the Black Mecca.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I have a question about that.
But okay, finish. Go ahead, no.
Well, how do you feel about culture? You know, in a Black community, this is a big, what I'm about to say, you may disagree, but you know, I'm just going to ask
go
you.
Go for it.
So I'm not against the whole Black Lives Matter or nothing like that, but I just feel it's deep, you know, and I'm just learning more about this. But I just feel like, I can say this because I'm a part of the Black community. I feel like a lot of Black people, they use the, you know, racism and, you know, all this thing, they use it as a crutch, or you know, to try to say, oh, we get this, we, you know, that's why we act like this, poverty and all this shooting and violence. And I feel like, you know, a lot of violence and, you know, things like that is promoted through, you know, the music we listen to and different things like that. And it's more so as culture now, you know, because yeah. this is what we put installed in our minds, you know. It's just like
you
a cycle.
You better speak to me. You better.
I'm serious. But I just wanted like somebody that can, you know, reason. And I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this, but like.
So much of our culture is rooted in imagery. But we have to understand it's a larger system that made us culturally want what we want.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that is real.
Right.
And that wasn't pushed by people that look like us. Mm-hmm. It was pushed by like old, rich white men.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are things in the culture that are still love.
Yeah.
Like there's no other community that I know I can go to that I can knock on a door and know that I can get food.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And a hug or keep going. You know, nobody might not have any money to give me.
Right.
But I know culturally, like I know where I can go for love.
Right. Right.
And it's also a place that if you knock on the wrong door, you can get shot in the face.
Yeah.
So you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And we do that to each other.
Exactly.
We do it to each other.
Exactly.
And I do believe that change really begins with us.
Yeah.
And it has to come from us in order to be real. Because like we remember like our grandmother's hugs and our mother's hugs, and we can give those hugs because that's what we're all really craving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've had a head start, you know, despite where you came from, your mom was very fervent about you doing something.
Right.
And that means a lot. The community supported you.
Yeah.
And not everybody has that. And
exactly.
So when you're surrounded by not having, you know, you're much more likely to turn to things so you can have something.
That was Nikki Lewis and Lanisha Gatewood. This conversation and others like it are available online at wutc.org. And you can subscribe to the Tennessee Valley StoryCorps podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This series is produced and edited by me, Will Davis, and created at the Pod Lab at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga.
This is Scenic Roots. We have a special treat for you on this afternoon's program. If you were listening last week, you heard the first half of the streaming show featuring the Fleet Finger guitarist Peppino D'Agostino playing in his home studio outside San Francisco. The show was streamed on the Barking Legs website on Saturday, August 9th. It was the third of three shows organized by Baker Booking in Asheville. They are also the curators of the Mountain Spirit acoustic series we've been featuring on Mondays. The first song this afternoon in the second half of the concert was written by Fabrizio De Andre, a singer and songwriter who was very popular in Italy in the 1960s, one of Peppino's heroes when he was a teenager. On Scenic Roots, this is Peppino D'Agostino.
Giorni perduti a rincorrere il vento, a chiederci un bacio e volerne altri cento. Un giorno qualunque li ricorderai, amore che fuggi da me tornerai. Un giorno qualunque li ricorderai, amore che fuggi da me tornerai. E tu che con gli occhi di un altro colore mi dici le stesse parole d'amore. Fra un mese, fra un anno, scordate le avrai, amore che fuggi da me tornerai. Fra un mese, fra un anno, scordate le avrai, amore che fuggi da me tornerai. Thank you. freddo dal sole o da spiagge gelate, perduto in novembre o col vento d'estate. Io t'ho amato sempre, non t'ho amato mai, amore che vieni, amore che vai. Io t'ho amato sempre, non t'ho amato mai, amore che vieni, amore che vai. Che vai. Amore che vieni, amore che vai. It brings me back to a different time in my life. I was a teenager when I listened to that song. And I want to play something now that I wrote for my late father. His name was Italo. Thank you. And it starts just with the left hand. How are you? I'm sweating a little bit. We're in California and it's hot in this room, but I'll keep going. I'll play a few more for you. I hope you're doing well. I hope you are safe in your home and eating well, exercising, learning new things, and listening to music. Using its strange tuning now. This tuning is, there's a lot of E notes in this tuning. So the tuning is E, B, E, E, B, E. It's basically B and E's notes. Thank you again for being with me. And I appreciate your support. So this piece, it's an interesting piece. For me, it is. It's a piece that I dedicated to David Tannenbaum. David is a dear friend of mine and is the chair of classical guitar at the Conservatory of Music in San Francisco. So this is, I dedicated to him because we're friends, but also David taught me a lot about classical guitar and classical music in general. That's why this piece is a combination of Baroque music and minimalism, which are two very different styles of music. You'll hear the difference because I'll go from one piece. The beginning is Baroque and the second part is minimalist. So you'll hear the difference. And so this piece is called Penumbra and dedicated to David Tannenbaum. Thank you. Nice to be with you. No, I can't see you, but I can certainly imagine your faces. And I appreciate all of you for being here. I will play one more piece for you, and this is a fast piece, energetic piece. I like to end on a positive, energetic note. This piece, I wrote this piece thinking about me and my little friends in Italy when I was 11, 12, playing soccer. You know, soccer is really a big sport in worldwide, and in Italy it's particularly huge. And I remember I was a pretty good soccer player. So I wrote this piece thinking about those days when we used to play, like, on the weekend, you know, Saturday, Sunday. We used to go there and play, like, 8 hours straight. It was crazy. We were playing in a field with there were no lines, nothing. We had a lovely, lovely time, 13, 14. And I know quite a few of those people still in Italy, we're still friends. So every time I go back there, we get together. We don't play soccer anymore, but we watch, you know, soccer games. In any case, I wrote this piece. And this is called Running Wild. Running after the ball, the soccer ball, running wild. Once again, thank you all for coming. Thank you to WUTC in Chattanooga, Richard Winham, and my agent, Louise Baker, and Bruce Swan, and my wife here for helping here in the studio. And my guitars, also, I'd like to thank very much Godin Guitars for building these guitars, and Dunlop Strings, and LR Bags, which builds the electronic that are inside this guitar, although I didn't use any electronics, but just a condenser microphone here in front of the instrument. So thank you all, and I will see you soon. Let's stay in touch, and all the best to you and your families. Running Wild.
Pino D'Agostino streamed from his home studio in California on WUTC. This is Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.